Alice Green, the longtime executive director of the Center for Law and Justice, a civil rights organization she founded in 1985, died on Tuesday. She was 84. For nearly 40 years, this center has been the foremost change agent in working to transform policies, practices, and people in the areas of social justice, criminal justice, and prison reform. In 2021, Alice wrote her memoir, We Who Believe in Freedom, Activism, and the Struggle for Social Justice, which exposed readers to police abuse and accountability, criminal justice and prison reform, and political abuse of power in New York's capital city. In speaking with her then, we talked about her life's work, the ups, the downs, and how she ended up in Albany.
Technically, I was born in South Carolina, but at a very young age, my parents moved to the Adirondacks. It's an iron ore mining town.
Mm-hmm.
And during the, I think during the 20s, they had a number of ethnic groups from particularly Western Europe who came there to be involved in iron ore manufacturing stuff. And so when the immigration policy changed and they didn't have as many people coming from Europe, the iron ore industry people went south to recruit black people. It's a very, very difficult business. It's a hot, dirty, dangerous business.
Mm.
So they recruited African Americans. And so that's how I got here. And then came here to go to college.
There's a picture in the book of you and your sisters with Myrtle, who is a friend and who is white. As you write in the introduction, the strong friendships were hard to come by in that town, but you were able to make friends with neighbors who were twins. But it was difficult.
Yes, it was very difficult. The town was, as I said, composed mainly of first and second generation Europeans. They were all white, and there were no people. Actually, there was only one other family in Witherby who was black or of color. And so it was very difficult for us to establish ourselves in a community like that. It was also Catholic. We weren't Catholic. And so it sort of put us outside of the mainstream. But yes, I was lucky and very fortunate to develop a friendship with people who live, right near me, next door. And they were from Canada. We were the same age and we became lifelong friends.
You mentioned a moment ago about wanting to tell the story of African Americans in Albany and in the state capitol. How unique do you think the Albany story is when it comes to that?
Well, certainly during the Great Migration, African Americans came to a lot of different communities. A lot of them were large communities, heavily populated communities like New York City, Chicago, and so on and so forth. So at least they had each other. But going to a rural community was very, very difficult because, like in my town, there was one other family. And so there was no understanding of who we were. Schools weren't prepared to deal with children of color. We were really sort of left out, and it made it very difficult socially, and also after a while economically, to get jobs. You just weren't hired because nobody understood who black people were. They were never involved with the civil rights movement. They didn't, totally walled off from the civil rights movement. So you're stuck in a town where you don't know who you are and they don't know who you are.
And in some respects, in many respects, 15, 20 miles away from here in rural areas, it's exactly that now.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's still there.
Where you may have a graduating class of 50 and you may have one African-American.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's still that way. I'm looking at the North Country because I still go there in the summer, and they're trying to mount a campaign to diversify. And I have a lot of discussions with them about that because they seem to be thinking more in terms of having people come, not necessarily large numbers, but to come and take part in the tourism business. But when I ask about, you know, are you really going to embrace people? Do you really want them to be living next to you, going to school with you and all of that? They haven't thought that through. It's just that there's this feeling that for some reason they need to diversify. And that only means having a black person maybe here or there, maybe some other group in the community, but not to really embrace them, their culture and their experiences. Most of the people in North Country make their living. I don't know if most, but a lot of them make their living off the prison industry.
Right.
And so, I'm really trying to have those discussions about doing the diversity and maybe doing something different if they really want people of color there.
So how do we do that better in the sense of it's just not a matter of numbers or that you add a few people, that you make your community welcoming to African Americans, to people of all color,
right,
to come in and to be an active participant in the community setting.
Right. Right now, there are at least a couple of groups up in the Adirondacks. I don't know about some of these other rural communities, but they have been discussing this issue. They have been planning programs to educate people about the different populations, indigenous people, and other people of color. They are getting more involved in some of the political issues in the town, like policing, for instance.
Yes.
And so they're trying very hard, but it's hard to get them to focus on what I think needs to be done. For instance, if you're in a community that relies very heavily upon prisons, you know, you're happy to use them for emergencies. You know, they go out when there's a fire or whatever it happens to be, or paint the town hall. But if you really want them there, when people are released from prison, for instance, it's a good opportunity to keep them in the community with housing and employment and, you know, things like that. So if you really want people in your community, you have to meet them where they're at. You have to give them and provide for them what they need, not just to say, come and, you know, in numbers and we can say that we're diversified.
So when you think of that and that idea of when people come out of prison, that they become a part of the community, but also in recruitment of the jobs of the school superintendents, mm-hmm. the hospital administrators,
sure.
the whether it be in town, city, village government, or just regular whatever jobs, and granted they're limited in rural mm-hmm. areas, but to include that population, how, and I don't know how you feel about this term, but this idea of recruiting and how you do that in a way that is fair and most importantly, I would think, genuine.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, I think a number of these communities are trying to find ways to recruit people. However, I think it takes more than that. For instance, as I mentioned before about housing,
yeah,
no one thinks about housing, that people have to live somewhere. Are you really willing to have a person of color live next door to you? And can you help them with that problem, that issue of housing and not only employment, but do you involve them in the social activities of the community? Because when I grew up in the Adirondacks, we were left out of all social events. I mean, there was just nobody wanted to have somebody who was not Catholic and white go to any of their events. So we're totally left out of it. So so it made it very, very difficult for us to feel welcome in a community. So it takes more than just doing this recruitment type thing and expecting that people are going to come, you know. And we also have to start working on things, and I think a lot of times in schools you can do this, on stereotypes. Stereotypes are prevalent. Since they've not grown up with or know people of color, they operate from all these stereotypes that they're, you know, especially if in a town when there's prison, that all right. black people are criminal.
But I'm, and this is a generalization, and please correct me of where I'm off base here, but one of the things that has fascinated me is that I myself live in a rural community, and you see a very small population of African Americans. Mm-hmm. What I do notice is those kids who then go to a college here in Albany or to elsewhere where there is more inclusion start to understand, and it immediately isn't an issue. And I'm curious, first of all, if you agree with that, and second of all, how we replicate that, because as you started to say, you're working with young people, and I mean, that is really kind of where it's at, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I believe working with young people is the most important thing. They're not so set in believing all these stereotypes, and they are more likely to be involved in other kinds of activities where you're going to see people of color, whether it's sports or theater or whatever it happens to be. So I think that's very, very good. They're having to overcome all of those stereotypes that have probably been taught to them by parents at some point. But I think students, on the other hand, can educate just about everybody, you know, because if they have those contacts, they're open to new ideas, they're open to cultural exchange type things. And that, I think, plays a major role in making some of those changes.
So you come into this city and into your work as the civil rights movement is gaining steam and traction here. So we could look at what you just said and say, all right, well, young people at that point perhaps were also more accepting, and those stereotypes were starting to come down. But have we seen that? Have we seen that bear itself out? Again, something that we can replicate, or do we look at that and say, all right, we're kind of in the same spot we were in the early 1970s?
Yeah. Well, we would like to believe that there's been some, been some change, very positive change. A lot of the students get involved. For instance, in 2020, after, you know, all of the demonstrations were taking place and, you know, people were in Albany were joining together, you saw a lot of young people were there. They understood how important it was to sort of branch out from their parents. Because a lot of the parents, I mean, I know parents who had their young people coming to Albany as part of the demonstrations. They didn't quite know how to handle it. So they were doing that. But when we look in 2021, we're not as optimistic because those demonstrations did die down. I mean, hopefully, some of the young people are still involved, but they died down. And we're not sure what it's going to take to rekindle that energy and that excitement about, being involved in change, in social change.
And that's one thing that you have been so good at in this community of saying that, okay, this is a moment and we are here, but then how do we keep going? How do we keep that momentum? And you know, I think of this as ancient history, and it was a year ago of 2020 as these demonstrations were going on in the streets of Albany. How do you feel? I mean, we look at the city and you drive down Central Avenue during that time. All the buildings were boarded up. What does that say? And how do we come to realize where we are? And I mean that geographically within the neighborhoods of this city, and how we provide some degree of trust that all people who come in to protest and to show concern aren't kept on, a very sterile path.
It's interesting because during that particular time when authorities and government officials were describing this as a riot taking place, we saw it very differently. I mean, people were reacting to a lot of things. And I didn't see it as, in my estimation, a riot is something that, you know, takes place with people having the intent to do damage, you know, and not really coming together as a group. But this was more of people, it seemed more like an uprising kind of thing, that they had a lot of issues that they wanted to react to. And so people were doing that. It was an uprising kind of thing. And I had seen this happen, I think I mentioned in the book, during 1968, when Martin Luther King was killed.
Right.
And when I went to Washington and saw what was happening, and I was listening very carefully to what people were saying when they were smashing windows or, you know, setting fires or whatever it happened to be. They were angry. They were reacting to a system that they felt did not treat them equitably. And so this was a way of doing it. And not only that, I think you also have to understand when people do that, there's a lot of criticism that said, well, you're burning down or you're destroying your own community.
Right.
You know, but you have to realize that most of these communities are not owned by the people who are in them. Somebody else owns them. Somebody else creates ghettos, you know, not the people who live in them. So it's not really seen as my community. You know, I live there, but it's not my community. So there's a lot of issues around that in terms of whose community is it and who's in control.
Well, this fascinates me because I remember during that time, again, not that long ago, but there was where people would say, and often police or government officials would say, well, the people who are coming into town and causing quote unquote trouble aren't even from this community. They're not from this town. And when you look at it, okay, no, maybe they're not from Albany, but they're from Colony, they're from Cohoes, they're from Saratoga, they're from, and this would be the logical place to come to be with other people and to express the anger, as you say. And I thought it was an odd reaction that you wouldn't expect people to come to the capital city to say, you know what, we're ticked off.
Yeah, well, see, these are some of the same people we were just talking about with young people. They have learned about other kinds of people
right.
beside themselves.
Yes.
And they've learned to understand what the problems and how racism works and systemic racism is. And so they some of them were identifying with this population. Now, they weren't all from outside. I mean,
no.
We wanted to say that it was a riot because you had these terrible people coming from outside. But that's not true. It's like we blame violence on gang members when nobody in the world knows that to be the case. People come with all kinds of issues about this society and their role and their place in it. And sometimes these things, I mean, there are always people who are going to, you know, try to take advantage of a situation. We realize that. We're speaking generally, you know, because there will be people who will try to do that, you know, for whatever reason. I think during that particular time, some people were from outside the community, but that doesn't mean they didn't care about what was happening. They might have understood, you know, better than some of our officials did what was happening and why they should be involved.
So did we move the needle after the George Floyd protest, the Black Lives Matter protest? Did we move the needle?
We thought we had moved it further than we actually did. And right after that, especially in the city of Albany and across the state, the governor had issued an executive order that pushed people to look at systemic racism, to really try to develop a program that would really be transformative in terms of the, making the kinds of changes that were thought necessary to do that. So we were very hopeful, but when we looked at what had happened after that, we thought there was still a big problem because a lot of the things did not take hold. The governor threatened to withhold money from jurisdictions that did not become involved in this transformative change effort. But there was it was not real. Mm-hmm. We knew because there was no effort to evaluate the change programs that were presented. We never believed that the state was going to withhold money from any jurisdiction, whether you did something or you didn't. And some of them didn't. And some of them just went through the motions. So we were very, you know, very disturbed and disappointed that we didn't have more change taking place after, you know, after the police killings and this effort to involve the community in coming up with transformative change ideas.
What does freedom mean to you of how we should define that?
That's a good question. And Nina Simone has a song. Mm-hmm. I wish I could know what freedom feels like. And it's very difficult since you've never had it. I mean, you know what you haven't had. You know that, you know, when you go somewhere and people in a different community and they look at you like with great suspicion or disdain or whatever it happens to be, you know, I don't like that. I want to feel like I'm part of this community, that I'm part of this country. I don't have to be fearful of people treating me differently. You know, I don't know what it feels like to be free, but I would like to. And that's what Nina Simone says, like a bird, that you could just do and be who you are without putting any, you know, any flags up or anything.
Speaking with Dr. Alice Green in December of 2021 about her book, We Who Believe in Freedom, we'll continue our look back at the life of Alice Green when we return. We present a 2021 interview with Dr. Alice Green in memoriam. She was the longtime executive director of the Center of Law and Justice. She died on Tuesday at the age of 84.
So much of your work, as the subtitle says, the struggle for social justice, and so much of your work has been about policing and jail and prison reform. We talked about this in our first segment about how what we can do in prison communities. But is that situation of how in your time through your work and your intensive work of how that, again, somewhat of a definitional question of what social justice can look like when it's going well, when it's being properly served.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's very difficult because one of the key elements here is systemic racism. I believe that that force is so strong in our country that it defines how people approach you. It defines how you are treated. Its impact is felt in my community when I see that more people of color would be in prison. I see it when we measure in many different ways why some people are in poverty or have poor medical care. And I look at what causes that. It's not because of my color. I mean, I'm not inherently criminal because I'm black. You know, it has nothing to do with my color. It has to do with the conditions that are set up to treat me differently. And they have an impact on how I respond to so many different things. So we have not really understood what systemic racism looks like, but we can see its impact and why people live in under different conditions, you know. And I believe right now it's very frightening for us, because now we realize that there's, you know, there's a country out there that's willing to do terrible things to make sure that blacks don't make advancements. I mean, there's and when you do, there's a kickback. Okay, like voting.
Well, right. I was going to say many examples of that, but yeah. the one that really has been making headlines, and rightfully so, is the voting laws that are being changed.
Absolutely.
And you see that in states like Texas and Arizona, but that's not saying that the voting laws here in New York are any great shakes.
Well, you know, every state is different, but certainly New York has its problems in terms of voting rights and districts, you know, redesigning districts and who's allowed to vote and who's not. I mean, states decide who's eligible to vote, right? In most of the states, for instance, people who are incarcerated can't vote, but they can in Maine and Vermont. You know, why is that? That doesn't make any sense to me. You know, and when we talk about this principle of voting, universal suffrage, I would think would be a major part of this democracy, that everyone should have the right to vote. And when we carve out exceptions or find ways not to allow people to vote, that means we're not a very democratic society. And, you know, so we have to understand that, and we have to try to figure out how do we get people to be a part of this country and this community on a fairly equal basis. And that's a lot of what we're trying to do. I mean, that's social justice, you know, when we're all on the same plane here.
About that, being on the same plane, I think we heard a lot during and immediately following the George Floyd protest about those who are white, who were certainly out in the streets and outraged. What do you see the role of an ally being to fully realize that role and to be, and I'm going to use this word again, but to be genuine in that role?
Mm-hmm. Well, we talk a lot about doing anti-racism work.
Right. Ibram Kendi talks a great deal about that.
Exactly. It's not just being silent or, you know, not acting in a vigilante type of way, but it's speaking the truth when you see it. It's speaking in support of equity and treatment. It's speaking to the importance of providing equal opportunities to people, whether it's healthcare, employment, or whatever it happens to be. So many people who believe that they are genuine, if you push them a little further, you know, they will say, well, I'm not willing to go that far. You know, I'm not willing to allow somebody to live next door to me that, you know, might devalue my property. And I find a lot of people are like that. They can speak in a great voice of being, you know, non-racist, but actions count a lot, too. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you willing to lay your life down for?
Dr. Alice Green is the author of the new book, We Who Believe in Freedom, Activism, and the Struggle for Social Justice. We will continue our conversation with Alice Green after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our guest this hour, social justice advocate Dr. Alice Green, who has just released a new memoir, We Who Believe in Freedom, Activism, and the Struggle for Social Justice. So let me ask this question, which is a difficult question for me to ask, and not so much because of its subject matter, but more because just of the language to use. But do you need us in the sense of for the struggle for freedom, for the struggle for social justice, do you need white America to work with you?
Absolutely. I think a lot of the leadership has to come from the black community, but you know, we're in a country that includes everybody.
Right.
So, and I believe in people power. And if you not only have black people involved in it, but you have white people and other people of color involved in that movement, you're going to be more powerful and you're going to make the kind of change that's necessary. So, yeah, we need everybody involved in the struggle, but the leadership has to come from the community of people of color.
Well, you certainly have long been a leader. So the book is very striking. There's a painting on the cover of it, and it's what I assume is the concourse in Albany. And there is police fencing on one side, and there's many activists behind you. And then there's that fencing. And in front of it, on the left-hand side, there are police forces, and they have shields and riot gear. And in between the fencing and those police forces is you. And you are holding your hand up. First of all, it's striking, and I'm interested in how that became the image, number one. Number two, how did you become that woman? The woman who became the leader, the woman who had all of those people behind her, working with her to stop those forces moving forward.
Right. This took place down in the south end of Albany when the city decided to remove a number of those demonstrators from their encampment.
Right.
And it was done in a violent kind of way. And I came on the scene, and the police said that, you know, civilians have to be behind this fence here. And the police were there without their badges. They covered their badges.
Right.
Which was sending a very bad message to the community. And so
they didn't want to be identified.
They did not want to be identified because they had been involved in some very violent activities. And so the people in the community were behind the barricade because police instructed them to. And so I came on the scene and I said, I will not be behind the barricade because this is my community. I want you to face me. You might not have your badges on, but I want you to face me. This is not what we should be doing. We should not be doing this in a violent kind of way. And so I stood there for a while. But the important thing was that while I'm standing there, some of the young people, they didn't know who I was. They realized that this woman was standing out there. And they said, wait a minute, she's standing there all alone. What happens eventually is that this one young woman comes and she, you know, she grabs my arm and she's standing there with me. She's saying, this is wrong. This violent approach to dealing with this problem is wrong. And then pretty soon, all of these people came around the barricade and they stood there and they faced the police.
And they're standing there with you.
Right. And I thought that was an important lesson for them that, you know, if you're in the movement, there are times when you have to make decisions about what you're willing to stand up for. And this was that moment. So I was very proud of them. The Black Lives Matter people were there and other people. Hopefully, you know, they were able to see that this really is an intergenerational struggle.
Right.
I had done this, you know, a long time ago. They got that message. And so I've been working with Black Lives Matter, young people and other people in the community to talk about and to figure out how we need to strategize to make sure that we do attain, you know, equity and social justice.
That work is never done, is it?
It's never done. It's never done. No, that's what the book comes from, the title, We Who Believe in Freedom, which was actually the words of Ella Baker, a great civil rights leader who very few people heard about because she was working behind the scenes, but she said that if you believe in freedom, the work is never done. That's the message that I try to get across, because now faced with all these other things that we mentioned, vigilantism and killing of people by police and all of this stuff, we've come a long way, but we're not there yet. We haven't attained real social justice in this country and freedom, but you can't give up. You have to keep at it.
You are an African-American activist. You were also a woman. And I'm curious as to if that has impacted, you're fighting, obviously, racism.
Yes.
But you're also fighting systemic sexism.
That's true. But I'm first and foremost an African-American woman.
Right.
You know, I'm African-American. And I look at the history of African-Americans in this country from a period of enslavement, you know, 1619, and we've been doing this for 402 years of fighting because of the racism that have put us in the situation that we're in. Being a woman is important, yes, you know, and it's hard to say which is the worst, but I think for me, racism is the major issue that we have to deal with, and sexism.
But you became a leader as a woman, which must have been difficult in and of itself.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm not in any way saying that it wasn't, because it was. But people see me first. And this is difficult. I have this discussion with white women.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of them have been able to benefit in ways that we can't as black women. The first thing I think people see when they see me is that I'm black. And then I'm a woman. So I have to deal with both of those things. But I'm looking at black people. I'm looking at African Americans as a group of people who are still struggling together, men and women. I know women were part of the civil rights movement, even though they weren't given, you know, the acknowledgement that they should have. They were very strong forces. And so I'm very proud of being a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized that racism is something that's going to take a lot more energy to get past, because, you know, with the change, white women are going to sometimes be able to get to places that black women can't, even though we're both women. Sometimes they can overcome some of these problems because of their sex, which isn't to say that it's not important. For us, it's very, very, very important to fight both on both of those fronts,
right?
Sexism and racism.
We heard during the 2016 election predominantly, but also in the 2020 election, where many white women were voting for Trump. And
yeah.
that you know, the bullet point to that was, well, they're not voting in their best interest. They're voting against their best interest. Do you feel that about the African American community?
I don't think so.
I mean, so in other words, if you don't have a black candidate,
yeah,
and you don't have someone who is, say, an Alice Green, how do you know?
How do you know who to vote for?
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Well, it's sometimes very difficult. You have to know what the candidate is all about, what they're proposing, how they look at issues around social justice. So I think a lot of black people want to know if this person's going to promote some of the things that I really care about. And a lot of times, as I said, it's difficult to, you know, to filter all of this out because, you know, as politicians, they're going to try to appeal to
right.
anybody and everybody. And, you know, and there were black, you know, I knew a number of blacks who voted for Trump, you know, and it sort of blew my mind because they heard him saying something very different than I did.
Right.
You know, but I think that, you know, a number of them, there's still a number of black people. Black people are not, you know, we're not all the same.
Of course not.
We think differently about different issues. But I think generally we're always looking for a candidate who will promote the things that we are really, we really care about. Sometimes there's greater trust in having someone who is of color. That doesn't mean that that person's going to work in your best interest always. All we got to do is look at the Supreme Court, and we can see that. But we didn't vote for him. But
great, yeah, that's a great point.
But it it doesn't mean that that person is going to, you know, further your goals and your ambitions. So,
in my reading of the book, I mean, certainly struggle is very much the story here of struggle. And your struggle and the struggles that have come. But there has been, and I'm interested of what you look as, and I know you probably aren't going to like this, but of legacy, of what you were able and have been able to change, of what you see as the work that you have done that you're proud of, that you have made a change in this community.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things is I'm persistent. I don't go away. And there were times when I was not at the table. I had to work to get at the table. Because if you work with your community, as I said, I believe in people power. And when the people in your community trust you and believe in you, somebody's got to listen to that, you know. And I think that has happened. I've worked to change the whole idea of community policing in the city of Albany. Luckily, you know, like when, for instance, when Mayor Jennings was deciding who to appoint as police chief, I was put on a steering committee because they felt that I would legitimize the group that he had selected to make this decision. And I was there for a particular reason, right?
Right.
And I was there because they knew that the community trusted me. And so, but at the same time, I was not about to do what they were suggesting, and that is pick somebody who was not good for the community, who was not committed to community policing. Because the mayor evidently had promised an FBI agent that he could have the job. And so I had to fight like crazy to make sure we got someone in that position who understood the community and who was supportive of community policing. So that's the kind of thing that I've been able to do. We brought the LEAD program into Albany, which is the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, because I had heard about that program. But then I'm able to work with the police department to and open them up to this idea of having this type of a program, and it happened. So, but a lot of it is really working with your community so that your community trusts you. And trust is a major issue and one that we've been trying to get across to the community, that unless the community trusts the police, not going to really make a whole lot of changes. Mm. So we've tried to work on that, tried to develop that as something that the city should be working very seriously on.
What do we do about the homicide rate in this city? Across the street from us, from this building where we're broadcasting from, there's a memorial. Mm-hmm. To someone who was gunned down.
Yeah.
And you need only walk a half a block the other way to see another one, and two blocks down to see a third or a fourth. I know this has been an ongoing problem, obviously, but it's certainly something that we have seen over the last year that has hit a frightening level, and not just in the city of Albany, of course. We've seen it nationwide. What do we do about that?
Okay, first of all, I think it's important to understand that it has nothing to do with race. Okay, a lot of people, when they talk to me about this, is the assumption is black people are violent, and that could be further from the truth. But what they have to understand is that white people who are under the same condition, who live under the same conditions as black people, they are more likely to be involved in violent behavior. So we have to look at the conditions that we have created and forced people to live under. We have to look at how people under these conditions are traumatized.
But I guess I certainly understand your point. But in this city, and obviously violence is a part of it. But what concerns me is that there are mostly young black men and women who are dying.
Yeah.
How do we stop that?
That's the problem. Unfortunately, we do. We come up with Band-Aid solutions.
Yes.
You know, like gun buyback, for instance, might be a perfect one.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with the problem.
That may make you feel good.
It might make you feel good,
but
absolutely. It's not going to say.
Yeah.
You know, you can throw basketballs out on a court every day, and that's not going to solve the problem.
Right.
You know? And we do a lot of those things. And also, we operate under misinformation. Everybody's saying, it's the gangs. It's the gangs that are causing the problem. No. Nobody knows that. We work in the community every day, and everybody will tell you it's not an issue of gangs. There might be, I'm not saying that the gangs don't exist, or there might be, you know, one or two or something like that. But we have to look at the conditions under which people live and how people are traumatized and how they see, how they're hopeless, how they solve problems in a way that perhaps you and I might not solve them.
Right.
But we have to look at those conditions first. Because what I was suggesting when I did a panel the other day was, okay, take a look at another suburb, for instance, and look at the city and see what the differences are. Do they all have good housing? Do they all have good schools? You know, are they all employed? Do they have good health care? And if you compare those two communities, I think you'll see a big difference. And those are the differences that cause the problems that we're experiencing. Because it's unbelievable how traumatized Black males are and how they only feel that there's, you know, there's one way of solving a particular problem. But it comes from a collection of conditions that they deal with every day. I don't think people understand what it's like to be a poor Black male. People don't accept you. You are, you know, you don't, you're not able to get what you need. You are, you know, all kinds of things happen to you as a result.
Right.
I'm not making excuses. I'm simply saying that this is the issue, that this is the problem that we're dealing with, and we're not facing it square out. We're saying it's somehow because of their race.
So what, if I'm understanding you correctly, there's really two issues there. One is that you have to reach out to that young Black male, but you also have to look at the systemic
Absolutely.
System and make sure that that improves
Absolutely.
For future
Right.
generations.
It doesn't happen without that. As I said, that's why I always try to compare those two communities and see
Right.
what you have. There are more guns in the white community than there are in the Black community. Always have been and always probably will be. They have guns, okay? But when you're in a situation where you are hopeless or you're traumatized or, you know, you're put in situations where you're stressed out, you might resort to using that gun. In a different community, you might do it differently.
Do you feel fortunate?
Very fortunate. I was lucky. I had my parents
right.
with me who loved me, took care of me, even though I was, you know, I lived in poverty. But there was that family and that love and that caring. I feel so bad for a lot of the young people I know who don't have that. They're born in situations where somebody might be a drug addict or you're living in poverty and poor housing, and they don't know how to deal with it. And, you know, one thing piles on top of another. So I'm fortunate. I had parents who realized that they wanted the best for their children. They left the South. My father was afraid of the criminal justice system because it was grabbing people up left and right. And employment was terrible. So they said, we want the best thing for our children. And even though I went into a society that didn't accept us really as equals, we were strengthened, I think, by our coming together and being a family so that we could deal with all the problems that we were faced with. And I'm very, very fortunate that that happened with my parents. But I'm, you know, not everybody has that.
And I touched on this earlier, but you realize how you're looked upon in this community. I mean, for many people, of looking at as a leader in the community and as someone who is the go-to person to try to understand these very important issues, which I think has to be a lot of pressure.
Sometimes it is, you know, sometimes it is because unfortunately people need somebody that they can trust
yeah.
and believe in and think that they can help with anything and everything. I mean, I get requests to do all kinds of things I couldn't possibly do. I know how to talk to people. I know how to make them feel better. I know how to find resources for them that they need that I can't deliver. But for instance, the one issue that I still if having trouble with is, you know, the police shot Eleazar Williams and he's paralyzed. We've been working with that person, trying to make this person whole again. That is so frustrating, so frustrating. And there have been people I've worked with that we weren't able to help and they might have ended up back in prison. And I talk about one of those cases in there, that somebody who had a drug problem, but people didn't catch it, didn't understand it,
Right.
catch it. and that person back in prison, that's a failure for me. I don't like that. I wished I could. You always wish you can do something, do more than you can actually do. But I have to, you know, I have to deal with that, that I can't do everything.
do you blame, when things like that happen, do you blame yourself or do you blame the quote-unquote, or can you blame the quote-unquote system that put it there in the first place?
I can blame the system. When we had one young man who we worked with, really worked with, did a lot with, ended up going back to, you know, robbing a bank. And because of his drug addiction. Mm-hmm. And people would come up to me and they would say, I know you work with that person a lot, and I feel so bad for you. And I said, no. You're feeling bad for the wrong person. It's not me. We should be feeling bad for him and how the mental health system failed him, how the criminal justice system failed him, how a whole bunch of things failed him. And I can't, you know, I can't take responsibility for that. I tried to help him, but there was a system in place that could not give him the kind of treatment and help that he really needed. And there are a lot of people like that, you know. So this is the system fails.
Overall in society and in our culture, it seems that empathy is lacking. Mm. But in the situation that you just described, especially empathy towards the African American community. And I don't know how far this goes, but how do we strengthen that empathy so that they're not coming to you and saying, I'm so sorry. They're going to that young man and saying, I'm so sorry. Right.
I wish I knew the answer to that. What we try to do is get people to understand what, and we're talking about systemic racism.
Right.
What it looks like and how it's used to maintain a system. And that's very difficult because if you come from an entirely different background and you're white, you know, how do you get that message? Because you've probably not been in that situation and it might be very difficult for you to do that. And we've tried all kinds, you know, like the exercises you can do. I mean, we've done them in colleges and things like that to get people to try to empathize with others, you know, putting them in situations. Sometimes they can get it, but it's very, very difficult. But I think we have to try to learn how to be empathetic, try to put ourselves in somebody else's skin, which is not easy. And I don't have a magic answer to how you do that. But I think you have to do is try it. You know, a lot of people don't even want to do that. They just say, hey, it's not me. You can't blame me for what my ancestor did. Yes, I can blame you for you didn't do it necessarily in person, but you have a responsibility to know what happened and how we got to where we are.
Yeah. And that's what strikes me as the responsibility that we have.
Yes.
That so many of us shirk that responsibility. Yes. And of a baseline understanding. And then, yeah, hopefully empathy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, so when people tell me, you know, hey, don't stop blaming me for what my ancestor did. And I said, I'm not blaming you, you know, but you need to know.
I feel guilty about everything, Alice.
You need to know what they did and how the impact it's still having on my life. You know, slavery might have, you know, ended in 1865, but the legacy lives on, you know, it's still there. I mean, people still think of me differently than they do other people because of that history. Everything that was done, the robbing and my ancestors' labor, they had nothing to leave to me like you do, you know?
Right.
So I don't have all of that. It's still there with me. And my great-grandmother was enslaved, and I knew my great-grandmother. I mean, I met her when I was young.
Right.
But so it's for me, it's not 1865 or where, however many years ago that is, it's still, the legacy is still there.
Did your parents get to see you in action?
It's just, yeah. Early on, yes.
Must have been very proud.
Yeah, right.
The book is beautiful. Your work is beautiful. And I thank you so much for sharing with us in such a great way and in a detailed way. The book is We Who Believe in Freedom, Activism, and the Struggle for Social Justice. It's a memoir by Alice Green. The foreword is by our friend Paul Grondahl, who is one of the best. And I just thank you so much for the work. I thank you for sharing with us this morning, and I wish you nothing but the best in the coming year.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Speaking with Dr. Alice Green in December of 2021, she was the longtime executive director of the Center for Law and Justice, a civil rights organization she founded in 1985. Alice Green died on Tuesday. She was 84. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.